once more into the breach, dear friends. They'll spill the wall up with their English dead. And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting second hour of The Personal Wealth Coach starring Jeff McClure. Jake is out of town down at the coast enjoying the balmy weather down there, and particularly the weather that's coming up this weekend when he is going to probably conduct an experiment, I understand, to determine if the Gulf of Mexico actually will freeze. And I suspect it won't. It'll just feel like it's freezing. Telephone number in here if you'd like to give us a call. Give me a call and make a comment or ask a question or anything of that nature about anything to do with the economy, the investing, the markets, or things of that ilk. Is still 254-773-1400. And we have a caller on 773-1400. And so, caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Hi, Jeff. This is John calling from Belton. Say, I heard something last week, and I was just wanted to get your opinion on it. I heard that to make the tax cuts permanent, they needed 60 votes, and not a single Democrat would vote with the Republicans, and that's the only reason why we didn't get permanent tax cuts. And I'll hang up and listen to your comments. Bye.
Well, it actually would have been a little more difficult than that, but they passed the procedure through the Senate on a provision. It's sort of a loophole that was never designed to be used for this purpose, but on a provision of reconciliation. And they previously had passed a budget resolution that allowed the deficit to be increased over the next 10 years by $1.5 trillion. Now, the Republicans could have passed a deficit, a budget resolution based on pure party line vote. It just takes a majority that increased the deficit, the additional deficit that they were going to incur by $2.5 trillion or $3 trillion or $10 trillion or whatever they wanted to do. But they took a look at the political impact of saying, let's increase the deficit instead of 10 years from now, the projection being that we will, even with all of the positives thrown in, have a debt held by the public of at least 100% of gross domestic product. Had they increased the additional deficit in there, we would have crossed the 100% line. And that, at least according to what I read from the analysts at the time that they were doing this, was the key. It's 10 years in the future that the bill obligates them to project, and to say, let's run the debt held by the public. Now, that doesn't count Social Security. It doesn't count Medicare. It doesn't count the social programs where we're giving money to ourselves. I'm talking about just the constitutionally obligated debt represented by Treasury securities on the that are actually sold by the Treasury at Congress's direction would hit 100% in 10 years, 100% of GDP. And apparently they considered crossing the 100% line to be politically sensitive and so limited the additional deficit to $1.5 trillion. So really the Republicans did it. And they are going to obviously attempt to say that if the Democrats had voted with them, they could make all the tax cuts permanent. Why didn't the Democrats vote with them? Well, there's a lot of reasons. Mostly, obviously, are political. But still, maybe you can answer this. Maybe you can give me an answer to this. Why is it now good to increase the deficit over the next 10 years by a couple of trillion dollars? That's a fairly conservative estimate at this point. Whereas when the Democrats controlled things, the same people were saying it's a horrible thing and we need to shut the government down because the deficit's too high. I don't know. Maybe somebody can answer that. We have another caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Hey, Rick in Salado.
Hi,
hey,
Rick.
Merry Christmas. Happy New Year.
Thank you.
I know it's belated.
Well, no. What happened? No, the new year hasn't arrived yet, so you're only half belated.
How about the weather? I was just curious about...
Yeah, we are having some, yes.
Yeah, a little bit of climate change. But anyway, I wanted to ask you about the Pentagon's or the administration's plan to audit the Pentagon. How many years do you think that's going to take?
It won't happen.
Huh?
Won't happen.
Won't happen?
No.
The Pentagon
already gets audited.
Do they? I don't know. That was a surprise to me.
It gets audited in little pieces.
Yeah.
And the proposal to audit the entire defense budget from one end to the other has been brought up in conservative circles again and again and again. And the answer is every penny that the Pentagon spends is accounted for and audited.
Right.
We'd have to create a few thousand extra federal employees,
mm-hmm.
career employees, out of qualified accountants, and give them maybe 10 years, and they could audit the Pentagon's expenditures. And if they did, it would be a disaster.
How about the 17 intelligence agencies? All those stuff. That's all money comes out of the treasury, right?
And every one of those, they have to account for every penny each year. Now,
well, I understand that they RFID all the equipment, but I don't know about
their what?
Other expenditures. You know, the equipment, you know, they do what all the big corporations do. You know, they consume a product, they RFID it, and, you know, it's tracked. What I'm saying is tracked.
True. And I think the government does, considering the size of the organization, I think it does a very quality job. Now, when you talk about waste, people talk about waste and abuse in the government.
Yeah, fraud and abuse.
Well,
waste, fraud, and abuse.
Well, yeah, I realize. You know that in government agencies, the fraud is mm-hmm. extremely low, and when it does happen, people go to jail.
Right. I'm all for that.
And when it comes to the waste, yeah, there's waste. And I was in the Army, and I know people that are still in the federal service in various places. Let me explain why the waste is there.
Yeah.
Congress passes laws because of some event that occurred somewhere or sometime, and they say, because this happened, we are going to put this restriction on this thing over here, or this, mm-hmm. or we're going to say this has to be done this precise way to do with the spending of federal money. Those laws accumulate over the years, and they become just absolute absurdities. They become astonishingly difficult to comply with, and they run the price of something up phenomenally. And let me give you an example. There's a series of laws and regulations derived from laws that had to do with cotter pins.
Cotter pins?
Yes. I don't think the law actually specified cotter pins, but it said that that there are certain minimum constructions for fasteners used for federal equipment. And when I was in the Army, I remember that. Because the thing is, it was the loss of a cotter pin, a little thing that sticks through the hole in a pin that holds something in place. I looked at the price on that, and those cotter pins were costing like $150 a piece. And the reason was...
And that wasn't a package of them?
A piece, okay?
Just a piece.
And the reason was the laws that were passed by Congress at various times because an airplane crashes because a piece of plating on it flaked off, on a component flaked off and got into the system, and Congress would feel obliged to do something about it, and so they would demand that the armed forces pass create a standard... that said, here's the precise construction that we're going to use on fasteners. Well, that cotter pin, that cotter key that goes in the cotter pin is a fastener.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can't go down to Ace Hardware or Home Depot and buy what is completely acceptable pin for everything else to put on a tank.
Mm-hmm.
We had to use the government-supplied versions that were outrageously expensive. And it's because the government contract is outrageously expensive. So if you go through and audit that, what the audits are going to find is going to go through and find that this is outrageously expensive. Well, the answer isn't because the Army or the Air Force or the Navy or somebody decided to make something outrageously expensive. It's because Congress, in many cases, put requirements on the purchase of those materials
Yeah, they wanted it a specified strength. Okay. Or
and somewhere, not just specified strength, in some cases they very carefully, well, in some cases the laws very carefully set up a situation where there was only one company in the United States that made that type of key because it was in the district of some congressman.
Yeah.
So when Congress says we want to audit the Pentagon, the auditors have to say, are you obeying the law? And they might find that, for example, they're buying keys that are made in Minnesota instead of New York and therefore in violation of the law and therefore should be punished for doing so. I mean, one of the things that I encountered when I served in the military,
the requisition
was that when auditors would come through, they would come up with some of the most idiotic ways of wasting time and money, and said we're required to do that, and they would ding us for failing to do something totally idiotic because the rules said it was supposed to be done that way, and what we'd done is we figured a workaround to make it less expensive, so. Yeah. You know, and I don't remember this, if you remember the story of the toilet seat that cost so much,
$70.
But again, that toilet seat was that cost that much because it had to be individually manufactured to meet a series of requirements that were placed there indirectly by Congress. Congress passes a law, and the various agencies in the federal government have to write regulations then to implement that law. And Congress often passes a law with very loose terminology in it that the members of Congress haven't read. And that loose terminology is so restrictive that when the government agency that has to live with this thing winds up writing the regulation or the rule that implements that law, it comes out and becomes just simply absurd. But does Congress then go back and change that? No, because there is no lobby. The federal agencies who do this are not allowed to lobby Congress and say, this is a really stupid law that you passed, you need to reword it. Now, I'll tell you an example. We just passed a tax bill.
Right.
That tax bill will ultimately wind up costing the federal government trillions of dollars. But I will guarantee nobody who voted for the tax bill read it before they voted for it.
The only ones that read that stuff are the lobbyists. They're the ones that make up the laws.
Nobody read that tax bill probably.
Or the bills. The bills up, don't they?
The bill was over 1,000 pages long.
Right.
And somebody may have read it, but I'll guarantee the members of Congress were way too busy doing other things to actually read it.
True.
And what we'll wind up with, I'll write this down, we'll wind up with another bill that passes next year to make massive corrections in the law they passed in 2017. And when you look at some of the corrections they're going to wind up passing, your mind will be blown. By the way, there's entire sections in that law, in the new tax law, that you read them and you go, what the heck is that doing in there? And then you read somebody's external analysis on it and you realize it's a provision in the law that specifically allows some business in some specific state to do something specific so they can get a congressman or a senator's vote. For example, there's one in there, we mentioned this last week, about craft beer, whether it pays 11% or 5% on the export of craft beer, and it all depends on whether there's pears in it or not.
Pears. Something you use for sugar?
Well, no, it's just flavoring. I mean, if in the process of creating the beer, you put pears in it
for flavor,
then it raises the tax to 11%.
Yeah.
And why is that? Well, because if you look at the entirety of that section of the bill, which is a lot, there's a lot of wording in there, you realize that there is a specific brewery in a specific state where there was a senator who was wavering as to whether he was going to support the bill or not, and that the deal was that brewery got a tax cut, a special tax cut from 11% excise tax for exports to 5% for exports because of the peculiar recipe they use for craft beer that they have patented.
Well,
that's the kind of thing when you say audit the Pentagon. No, we don't need to audit the Pentagon.
Well, the nice thing about the tax, if anything, is that they doubled the exemption, right?
Oh, really, really nice. They increased everybody.
Well, I mean, they doubled it for the low man on the totem pole.
Yeah,
I mean,
wonderful. But the point is, again, this is my point.
Freedom, we haven't gotten that much in a long time. It was only increments.
You didn't get it.
Uh-huh.
You obligated your children to pay it with interest.
Mm-hmm.
Is that because
we have to borrow money again? Is that what you're saying?
That's right. What we're going to see next year is a dramatic increase in federal borrowing, and the conservatives in the House are already lining up for a fight to cut off the limit to the borrowing limit by the Treasury, and if necessary, shut the government down.
All right.
Because
another
we're borrowing too much money, but they just voted for a tax bill that says cut taxes and borrow more money. If somebody would explain that to me, I would love to hear an explanation.
You remember when Bush cut a check? Did they make this retroactive for this last year? This tax bill, did they push it forward or did they retroactively do it?
It starts in 2018.
Okay, so there was no retroactive tax rate for 2017.
No.
2017.
No. It starts...
Weren't they talking about it?
No.
But they didn't do it.
No. They never really discussed that because it would run...
Would
run the deficit.
Because I remember during the Bush years, you would get a check for 2000...
No, that was a stimulus. A stimulus. That was a separate deal.
That was a separate deal. Okay. Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, thanks for calling.
Later.
All right. And this is the Personal Wealth Coach, and you're listening to Jeff McClure.
And the telephone number in here remains 773-1400. Local area is 254. Let's talk a minute about where we are in history. Let's talk a minute for what's likely to happen next year and what's likely to happen in the years as we move forward. We have come out of the recovery phase. This is one of the longest recoveries that we've ever been in the history of the United States. Certainly not a record, but it's up there. It's in our memory, in the memory of those of us who have been around for a while, this recovery has taken quite a long time because the bottom of the downturn and the recession was in 2009. And it was in 2017 that we completed the recovery. Now, the recovery means coming back up to normal. That doesn't mean coming back to the same level as the market or the same a lot of things. It means that there's a trend line in the economic activity and in the markets in the United States that's pretty consistent. When we dip below that, that's when Jeff McClure's definition of bear market or recession or whatever you want to call a pullback occurs. It officially ends when we hit bottom and start back up again, and then the official economic definition is that the economic expansion began in 2009. I don't use that definition because as long as we're down below that trend line where we would have gone had the event not happened, then we are still in recovery. And here's how you can tell when you're in recovery. When you're in recovery, the news media and people who have to do with investing and the economy are still deeply concerned about falling back into recession. They're still deeply concerned about this could re-trigger a bear market. The market could crash any day. When that dominates the news media, and the news media is driven by people who listen and watch, they're very, very sensitive to that. So the news media is a reflection of the recipients, the people who are in effect purchasing the news. So when we are still in the, I'm afraid this is going to happen again, we are still in recovery. During 2017, we transitioned from the, I'm afraid we're going to fall back into the events that happened in 2008 and 2009. And we began to say, this could go on forever. This is a good time. I missed out on this, and probably one of the principal things we saw that was indicative of that is Bitcoin and people wanting to jump on Bitcoin. I still don't know how high Bitcoin will go. I don't know what will happen to it, but I can say that there's a very, very high probability that at some point it will suffer a collapse and nobody will ever, as a matter of fact, people will say, well, this is just another one of its intermittent 25% drops, and this time, though, it will just spiral into oblivion and be one of those forgotten things in history because it has no intrinsic value. And there have been a lot of things in history that people have bid up a lot over an extended period of time that had no intrinsic value, and all of them wound up in the same ash heap of history. And the trick is knowing when this is going to occur. The issue is nobody knows when it's going to occur, and it's something we call the greater fool theory. As long as there's a greater fool who will buy more from you at a higher price, well, then there's money to be made, but there's also a lot of money to be lost. So we stay away from that type of thing. We're thrilled with the idea at the Personal Wealth Coach and here and personally that, as an example, the Dow Jones Industrial Average has gone from 1,000 to nearly 25,000 in 35 years. That's good enough. That's the kind of gains that are there for a reason. They're there because of something called utility. American corporations are creating a better lifestyle, a better standard of living, and generally speaking, a better world. Now, the people who will agree disagree with me on that, and we could debate on it very nicely, and I think I'd win. All I got to say is the drive of American corporations and capitalism is why you can go into the grocery store today in the middle of winter and buy fresh vegetables and fresh fruits that have been flown here from the other hemisphere, from the southern hemisphere. That's there because corporations figured out how to do it in a free enterprise system. Does the free enterprise system work 100% of the time perfectly? No. There are times when there needs to be a balance, and that's what government is there for. One of the things the government is there for is to balance it out, and Adam Smith wrote about that. But still, that is the utility produced by those companies, those corporations, as they produce fruits and vegetables and flowers for your use. It improves your lifestyle. It improves the way we live. It improves a lot of things. It improves our enjoyment of life. We have a new OLED TV, and we find that to be delightful. Again, that's something that was produced, that the value of the company that produced that television, the value of its stock, is appropriately been rising for the year because they produce something to produce more pleasure, more enjoyment in our family and in families across the country. And that's where the value of stock is. And that's the way it's got to go. Moving on, what's the market like to do next year? The best estimates I've heard is something around 12%, which still is very, very good. I can say that sometime in late 2018, going into 2019, things begin to look a little more problematic. It becomes questionable how long we can continue this boom. And eventually, it's going to end in a bust. And what will cause it will be excess, and the excesses are beginning to bubble up around the edges. But meanwhile, back at the ranch, things look very good for 2018. So let's put this in a bigger context. There are three books that I highly recommend to people. And if you read all three of them, you basically can understand everything that's going on in the world. One of them is Structure and Change in Economic History by Douglas North. He got the Nobel Prize in, I think, 1993 for that book and two others. This was the centerpiece. And in it, he says that there's something called institutional economics, and we can understand what's going on in the world based on institutional economics. And he made some forecasts. The book was written in the 70s. And late 70s, early 80s, and he got the Nobel Prize in 1993. And so you look at the book, if you read the book, you will find that he predicts a lot that's going on economically in the world today, and he predicts it with amazing accuracy. Another one is Generations, The History of America's Future, 1584 to 2069 by Strauss and Howe. That's another book that is, again, written in the 70s. Intensely predictive. Predicts exactly what Congress is doing today. Predicts what's going on in the world today very, very, very accurately. And that's the standard I use. And, of course, and then the third one is The Great Wave, Pricing Revolutions in the Flow of History. I think it's Pricing Trends in the Flow of History, maybe, by David Hackett Fisher. And it says that there's some big movements through history that are cyclical and that are predictable. So what we can see is these predictable events occurring through time. Excuse me just a moment. We have these cycles through history that these books do a good job of explaining, not just that the cycle occurs. If somebody simply says there's a cycle, the Condorcet cycle, and there's a number of cycles out there that are predicted based on reading history, and that's called data mining, where you go back and you can find a cycle. You can find cycles all through history. You can find cycles for all kinds of things. But if you don't look at the cause of the cycle and say, here's why this cycle is occurring, and if this why is true, then we should see this other thing over here and this other thing over here. And you go find all of those things occurring because of the cause. And if you figure out what the cause is, then you say, okay, if that's true, then this should happen 10 years from now, and this should happen 20 years from now. And that's why the three books that I just cited, all written in the 70s, they're all written 20 years at least before the end of the last century. So now we're 37 years, almost 38 years, into the future being forecast by these books. And those three books have been amazingly accurate in their forecast of what was coming. That indicates to me that if we take the rest of that forecast and take a look at it, we can say that also has a probability of occurring as we go forward. We're coming out of a major socioeconomic cycle that was created during the, not a major, but a mid-range economic cycle that was created with the collapse that we saw as a result of the collapse in 2008 and 2009. But there's a bigger issue going on around us right now, and it is one that has already begun to affect our lives and will have a profound effect on our lives in the near future. If you listen to the end of the last hour, you realize I said that the number one use of the tax windfall that corporations are going to get in the United States, according to Bloomberg, is reinvestment into expanded plants and equipment by corporations. Now back off and realize that the unemployment rate is 4.1%, which is as close to full employment as you're likely to get. The corporations around the United States are having a great deal of difficulty finding qualified workers. It's not a matter of there are lots of workers out there and they don't want to work. Just not true. They certainly have people applying to fill jobs. But we have, as a percentage of the workforce right now in the United States, the largest percentage of job openings to actual people working that we have had since we've been keeping records on this. We didn't keep records during the Great Depression and some other times, so we don't know what that is. But right now we have multiple job openings that are posted that companies want to fill for every job applicant. And the people who are not able to find employment are not able to find employment because they don't qualify for any of those openings. That's it in a nutshell. And that is something that we should pay attention to. Now, we've had this happen before in history. And is that when that happens, what we see historically was stated in something called the Phillips curve. The lower unemployment goes, the higher inflation goes, because companies start into a bidding war for the qualified employees who are capable of doing the work that they need to do to expand into an economic expansion, which is what we've moved into now. We moved out of we're afraid it's going to collapse again into it's time to expand and catch this deal before the profits go away. So why aren't wages going up? And that's Janet Yellen has referred to that as a conundrum. She's referred to it as a problem. I actually don't think there's as much problem there as she indicates. The problem is easily solved if you realize that we're in a global economy, and this has happened before. We have a caller on 773-1400. So, caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead. Hello?
I'm next, or what?
You were on the air.
Oh, okay. This is Dr. Bob Wynn. I have AAA bonds. My question is, they were bought in 1990, and of course in 2020, they're 30 years. My understanding is they don't draw any more interest after 30 years.
Oh, you're talking about savings bonds.
Yeah.
That's correct. But you got to look at it. I'm not familiar with the specifics of the bonds you hold. What you need to do is there's an online place at the Department of Treasury on savings bonds, and you can ask about those specific bonds.
Okay. And I'm not about to, after 30 years, lose money or a chemist.
Well, you won't receive any more compensation for holding them.
Yeah. Right, so I need to start so it won't spike my taxes, start cashing them in
now,
the next three years.
Were they zero coupon bonds, or have you been receiving interest and in paying taxes over the years?
Zero. I haven't been paying any taxes.
Okay, well, then when you do sell them, you're obviously going to be taxed on. Next year would be a good time to start selling them because tax rates will be down.
Oh, okay.
Okay?
Thank you.
All right. Well, thanks for calling.
And that caller was on 773-1400, which remains our call-in line. We are in an interesting position here where the shortage of available labor, well, we got another call on 773-1400, and you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Hello?
Hello.
You're on the air.
Oh, hi. I'm actually in the medical equipment, device, and pharmaceutical sales industry, and it's amazing to me that the government would be able to fix tons of the healthcare deficit spending issues just by one law. Passing one law that says any device that you sell to the government, because they're the biggest customer, has to be at your lowest contracted rate with any of the
interest. You and I agree completely. And when the prescription drug benefit went through, there was a provision in the prescription drug benefit, which again was passed. And I'm not trying to be partisan. I'm just simply saying it was fully Republican votes and a Republican president that said that Medicare cannot negotiate for the price of medical equipment or drugs. They have
right.
to pay whatever the seller wants to charge them.
That's exactly right. And so my specific device is literally the government is by far probably by 8 or 10 times they purchase 8 or 10 times the largest insurance carrier of my product, yet they pay reimbursement of double.
Yeah,
it's absolutely absurd.
Yeah, it is, and it is.
And that's the swamp that needs to get drained.
You're right, and
if somebody doesn't start barking about it, then there've been
a lot of people barking about it. But very frankly, the pharmaceutical and equipment and medical equipment industries are great contributors to the Republicans and not to the Democrats. And as a result, no Republican, and they're controlling things. No Republican is going to come along and bite that hand that feeds them.
Yeah, that's where I'm hoping that the drain the swamp No. Trump's not really a Republican.
Well, he's not really a Republican, and he wants to have support in Congress. And very frankly, there have been a lot of people over the years that have come up and pointed out that you're talking about waste, fraud, and abuse. It's right there.
Absolutely.
And it is absurd. It is ridiculous. But as long as the lobbyists continue to fund the reelection campaigns of the people who make the laws and make the rules, nothing's going to change.
Absolutely. I agree.
Okay. Well, thanks for calling.
Hopefully they'll be. You bet.
Okay, bye-bye. And you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach.
I know you want me to probably continue to talk about where we are historically. Unfortunately, I'm going to have to play some commercials, and we'll be back hopefully on the other side with the ability to give you some information about where we are in the big economic scheme. When we'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. And this is Jeff McClure. The Jake is down on the coast, so I'm here by myself today. And I wanted to finish this story about where we are according to some really very accurate, so far, history books. We are entering into the third industrial revolution. And we are blowing into it at a pretty high rate of speed. The tax cut will accelerate that. The third largest use anticipated by corporations for the money they bring back from overseas, as well as the first use that comes up on the list for companies that are not bringing back money from overseas, is modernization, is expanding facilities. And right now, they can't find people to hire. They also can't raise wages. Why can't they raise wages? Because they can't raise prices. Why can't they raise prices? They can't raise prices because if they're making something and they're in competition with somebody in Europe or in China or in Mexico or in even another state, the cost of bringing the something that's made somewhere else into competition with them is negligible. So they have to keep their prices down. And if they're going to keep their prices down, they can't afford to raise expenses. And if so, what they cannot afford to do is pay a lot more wages and get into a bidding war. This is where we've been. It's the Phillips curve, it's called. This is where we've been in the past when we got inflation. We got inflation because we get into an expansion. We get a shortage of workers. We get effectively zero unemployment, which is around 4.1%, which is where we are. And we reach this interesting position where companies start in a bidding war for employees. And in the bidding war for employees, the prices that they're paying for employees start up. And then they start across an industry. All of the employers begin to raise their prices simultaneously to accommodate the higher wages, because labor is inevitably, at least historically, the highest cost factor in anything that somebody does. And that is the most fundamental cause of inflation. Now, there's other reasons that inflation can come into existence, something as simple as there being too much money in the system. But money in the system isn't what it used to be. Money in the system, this is an important thing to understand when it comes to inflation, is not created by the federal government. It's not created by the Federal Reserve. It's not created by anybody except banks. When banks loan money, they create money, because the money is both sitting in a deposit in the bank, your money, and it is in somebody else's locale doing something. And that, so what you get is this: as economic expansion goes forward, we create money. If everything is running smoothly, we only create money at the same rate of speed as we create new goods, products, and services in the system. And that generally works pretty well until we get a shortage. And when we get a systemic shortage in the system, and that's what economics is all about, then the price of whatever that shortage is, the price of that commodity starts up. Now, if there's an alternative commodity, for example, historically, if the price of steak gets too high, people buy more pork. And that limits how high the price of steak can get, because people will, more and more people will eat chicken or they'll eat pork or something. And this is historic economics, and that works out really well. But labor is a different issue. Historically, there has been no alternative to hiring people to do things. But on three different occasions in history, that wasn't true. And in all three occasions, we got very low unemployment, followed by low inflation, followed by a lot of interesting things that went on after that, and these are called industrial revolutions. The first one, if you've ever watched or seen or read A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens, or A Tale of Two Cities, or any of the other Dickens' work, Dickens was writing about a time period during the first industrial revolution when a lot of handmade goods that had been made in the villages in cottages called cottage industries had transferred to being made in factories, many of them driven by waterfalls. Large leather belts transferred power to machines that did a lot of work. It was also during that period of time that things like the McCormick Reaper came into existence, and the cotton gin, and things where previously items that were very expensive became very inexpensive. We had deflation, we had our very low inflation across the board, because machines replaced people. And we had tremendous economic booms during those periods, we had big expansions during those periods, and it all worked out the same way. Now, when was the second revolution occurred? Not all that, again, with the advent of the steam engine. And so we had one in the 1830s that was the first and second. Those two revolutions occurred together. Basically, the steam engine and the waterfall changed the way we applied power. We had factories. Now, the next one that occurred after that, the next big cyclical revolution, industrial revolution, occurred with the advent of the internal combustion engine. And if you want to see the results of that, then drive just a little east of here to Holland or one of the little towns just east of here, and if you drive through town, or Bartlett, and you see that there are banks, buildings that are made out of stone or brick in these little towns, and there obviously at one time was a lot of prosperity there, and it went away. It vanished. Now you've got boarded up buildings and ruins. By the way, that's happening across rural America again today. We are repeating that revolution in many aspects. What caused that revolution? The internal combustion engine. Just as the steam engine, the source of energy and the ability to transmit energy changed everything, the railroads, the ability to do transportation, the ability to create energy to do things at various places that enabled machines to do the things that people previously did. And what you get is both a boom that goes on in one part of the economy, and we're seeing that, and a bust that goes on in another. And if you go back to the last one, you can see a lot of parallels coming forward today. The industrial revolution of the internal combustion engine in the 1920s and 100 years ago displaced ultimately over 90% of the people who'd been working in agriculture. Over a period of several years, actually about a decade or two, most of them ceased to have gainful employment, which ultimately led to the Depression. It certainly didn't. Inflation was the big fear, and coming out of because we had a big bout of inflation coming out of World War I when wages and price controls were lifted, so Congress fought inflation, and in the process they didn't realize what they were facing was deflation and massive unemployment coming down the road, and they refused to invest. Franklin Delano Roosevelt and his New Deal came along with initially the Works Progress Administration and later the Civilian Conservation Corps when the WPA was ruled unconstitutional. We're coming up on one of those again, and why do I say that? This tax cut, which, by the way, parallels one 100 years ago, will enable companies, seeing a shortage of labor and the inability to raise wages to buy, to get into a bidding war to get people in, robotics is going to take off. And you can say, well, you know, I really don't believe that. I don't see it coming. I can't imagine it coming. All I got to do is say, you're not opening your eyes and looking around. Corporations are creating more stuff with not the same number of people, but fewer people. We're not seeing massive layoffs. What we are seeing is an absence of hiring. As older workers who are highly skilled move out of the system, they're being replaced with automation, with robotics, if you will. And a few years ago, I had people seeing me who were telling me that, for example, Wilson Art wasn't going to be able to make it because they had all these pieces of equipment and nobody knew how to run them but them, and the whole place would collapse because they were being bought out and retired. And Wilson Art hasn't collapsed. It's still cruising along nicely, and its parent company is more profitable than it was back then. How did they do that? They gradually replaced old equipment and the very highly skilled in that one narrow area workers, many of whom didn't have any formal training. They just learned over the years on that machine. They replaced those machines with automated machines. This is going on across society, and when we look at the fact that the number one use of the tax break across industrial America is going to be to replace, to expand using robotics, we've got something significant going on. And when you turn around and look very specifically at one area that's very, very visible to all of us, and that is the autonomous vehicle issue. If you look at the trucks going up and down the highway, all the commercial vehicles going up and down the highway, if you get out and drive, and you realize that every one of them has one, or in some cases two people in it that are being paid full-time, and you realize that the technology is on the verge of going, like in 2019, going into widespread use that will replace those people. So trucks, right now, every time you drive past a truck stop or every time you drive past a rest station, a rest place on an interstate highway, you'll see it full of 18-wheelers. Why? Well, because there's a limit to how many hours those drivers can drive before they have to stop and get some rest. It's good that we have those regulations, because otherwise they get sleepy and they kill people. But if you could keep that truck running, other than refueling 24/7 because the driver's not driving, and even if there's a driver in it, and the driver's not driving, it will triple the number of miles a truck can put in a given period of time because the driver doesn't have to drive. Now, could it be that the regulations won't change and the driver will still have to get the rest and all of that kind of stuff? Entirely possible, but I don't think so. I think we will rapidly move to the point where we're going to see drivers across the board being replaced. You think about the people who operate forklifts at McLean and other places, and I've known some of them over the years. What you're going to find is the automated forklift is right around the corner. I thought maybe still this was some kind of pipe dream until Jake went up and visited some of his in-laws in Canada, where there is a huge wheat farm, and the farmer in the morning gets on his computer and programs his harvesting and tillage and everything else, his machines, to go out and do the work in the fields, and they go out and do the work in the fields, and they come back at the end of the day and stop. And yes, he does have to go out and service them. He has to put fuel in them, and he maybe has to have an employee to go around and check their bolts and make sure everything is working on them and to fix them when they break down. But it's nothing like the number of people even a few years ago it would have taken to drive tractors, which were obviously far more efficient as far as man hours were concerned than mules. And we already have the second industrial revolution has already hit agriculture. It will soon be hitting everywhere else. It's the and in the process, and this is an important thing to understand, the gap between the haves and the have-nots will spread, and it'll spread in a very obvious, but I think in many ways unexpected manner. The ills that we're seeing in rural America today with the high opioid addiction rate, they're detailed in several magazines. The Economist and others have detailed this out, and it's horrific. The mortality rates, the teenage birth rates, you look at all the statistics for rural America. The 180,000, I think it said, counties, and I may have the number wrong, it may be 80,000 counties in the United States that don't have a major metropolitan area within one county of where they are. And you see the same economic malaise that hit the inner city in the 1960s. And you're seeing very much the same results with some really, really, really unhappy people and some really bad things happening. I wish I could go on with this. We are entering into a time period when we are going to be undergoing accelerating socioeconomic change. It will be accompanied by a great boom that will leave certain people behind. And unfortunately, I can tell you in a decade or two, and I can give you the approximate date, about the same time this tax law runs out, around 2027, we're probably going to see, we're going to get to pay the piper, and it is wise to be prepared for that. Well, you have been listening to The Personal Wealth Coach. My name is Jeff McClure. You can contact me off the air at either, you can give us a call, and we have voicemail at 254-947-1111. You can call us at 1-800-914-7526, 1-800-914-PLAN, or you can send me an email at jeff@tpwc.com, and I'd love to respond to whatever you have to say, and it will help me for next week when we go on the air again and in 2018, and hopefully Jake will be back, and we'll be able to have a good time.